the streetlights come on. It's getting dark. She's supposed to be home before the streetlights come on. She wasn't home yet, so I'm thinking she's just out there playing with a friend. She never came home.
She should be playing with a friend. She should be going to school and enjoying herself. Not strangled, murdered, and treated like a piece of garbage.
Seeing her laying there smoldering is tore you up. It's one of those cases that never leave you. And Stanley's making sure of that.
There's no doubt whatsoever in my mind or heart that they have the right man.
He looked at and or processed 10,000 items of evidence and never found anything that connected Jennifer and Stanley.
I mean, I like cheese, but I'm not a rat. I like kids, but not like that.
You're listening to Suspect Convictions, a podcast from WVIK and Scott Reeder. I'm Lacey Scarmano. We are now about 2 months away from the beginning of the Stanley Liggins trial, but for this episode, we're going back to 1990. At the time of Jennifer Lewis's murder, Stanley Liggins was living at the Hillside Inn, a motel on the west end of Rock Island, Illinois. After police made the connection between Stanley and Jennifer's family, they went to the motel to talk with him. They knocked on the door of room 54, and police took Stanley to the Davenport Police Department across the river in Iowa for questioning. He wasn't under arrest at this point, but the police did handcuff him. At the police station, Stanley signed a consent form for officers to search his room, but there is a dispute over how they got him to do this. Stanley told reporters he signed the form on the condition that officers wouldn't use anything in the room against him unless it was related to the murder. But that didn't end up happening. We wanted to see what the motel was like, so Scott Reeder, our producer Alfredo Monteca, and I went to the Hillside Inn. And I know we're seeing it nearly 30 years after Stanley Liggins lived there, but I honestly don't think it's changed much.
Smells like smoke.
It really reeks smoke. So this is a pretty tiny place. This is where Stanley Liggins was living. We know that he had, when they exercised the search warrant, they found things here. They found some drug paraphernalia. They found a grinder, which apparently is like almost like a which he used to make powdered sugar for cakes. I mean, it grinds up the cocaine from kind of a hard rock to a fine powder. They found trace residues, allegedly, of cocaine on that grinder.
Police arrested Stanley Liggins for cocaine possession, again, despite the fact that Stanley claims he signed the consent form on the condition that police couldn't use anything they found against him, unless it was related to the murder. A couple of days later, they did end up arresting him for the murder of Jennifer Lewis, and they towed his red Peugeot out of the parking lot of the Hillside Inn. As we know, Stanley's red Peugeot played a big part in both trials. The prosecution brought the back end of the car into the courtroom to show the jury how one taillight was partially burned out. That was based on a witness describing similar taillights at the scene of the fire where Jennifer's body was found. That's the witness who was also a paid police informant. But another witness, named Donna Adkins, also gave testimony about the car. Her boyfriend was staying at the Hillside Inn, and Donna says she often saw the car in the parking lot. So, Scott, why don't you tell us a little bit about what Donna testified to during the two trials?
She was at the Hillside Inn moving her boyfriend out of his apartment there, or out of his, shouldn't really call it an apartment, out of the hotel room where he was staying long term, to a drug rehabilitation center. And she was walking up and down the stairs at the motel, carrying boxes to her car. And the car she kept walking by when she came down to the foot of the steps was a red Peugeot, which in the Quad Cities in the 1990 was a fairly unusual car to have. And she said each time she walked by it, she smelled a strong odor of gasoline. And this was particularly noticeable because she said she just kept going by it over and over again, and each time she'd get a whiff of gas. And she also noticed a gasoline can in the back seat area. So she was a pretty critical witness in this case. What's interesting is there was some, as we've previously reported, some police reports that were not turned over to the defense during their discovery motions.
During pretrial hearings a few weeks ago, these missing reports were brought up quite a bit, which makes sense because the fact that a judge ruled that the prosecution did not turn over all evidence is the reason Stanley is going back to trial. We've mentioned Kent Simmons several times during this podcast. He's the lawyer who represented Stanley Liggins through the appeals process. He's been working for Stanley off and on since after the first trial in 1993. Kent's the one who determined the defense was missing evidence. Kent Simmons testified during one of the pretrial hearings. The current defense team has filed a motion to allow Kent to testify during the trial. We'll talk more about that in another episode and how unusual it would be for a lawyer to be a witness in a case. But today we're just focusing on what Kent said about the missing reports while he was on the stand.
Mr. Simmons, would you raise your right hand? Do you swear affirm to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Seat right here, please.
Defense attorney Derek Jones questioned Kent about how he discovered the reports. And Kent says it all started with a conversation with a woman named Sarah Klingsek.
At some point, did you become aware of a witness named Sarah B. or Sarah Klingsek?
Yes, I did.
When did you first become aware of her?
Ms. Klingsek, at the time she contacted me, her name was Klingsek, had formerly been B, that's B-E-A. She called me at my office sometime, I would say, late in 1996. And she told me that she had information.
Without getting the specifics of what she said, did she provide you information in connection with Mr. Liggins' case?
She did.
Did that lead you to seek any police reports that might have been generated concerning Ms. Klingsek?
Yeah, I'm not certain exactly how that happened, but I did eventually file a post-conviction action for Mr. Liggins, which was largely based on what Ms. Klingsek had given to me for information.
We've talked about Sarah Klingsek before in the podcast. She's the woman who described three white men at the scene of the fire. During the appeal, the first defense team turned over all their information, evidence, and reports to Kent Simmons. And after reading everything, Kent realized there was no mention of this witness. So he asked the Davenport Police Department for any information they had on her in relation to this case.
I can't remember whether I had subpoenaed a report concerning Ms. B or Mr. Schaefer just produced it when he came to a deposition. I had a discovery deposition in that first post-conviction action.
Mr. Schaefer, you're referring to Donald Schaefer, a Davenport Police Department officer?
Correct.
When he discovered there was a report concerning Sarah Klingsek, or Sarah B., at the time of the murder, he wanted to investigate whether there were any other reports that didn't get turned over. Kent says he requested all police reports that had been generated by the department during the Liggins investigation from former Scott County Attorney Bill Davis.
I'm not certain whether I actually filed the motion or just asked Mr. Davis for all the reports, but he came up with the process by which we would do it.
Right. What was that process?
Mr. Davis's proposal was to have the Davenport Police Department provide him with a printout of every report connected to this investigation that was in the computer at the Davenport Police Department. Then to have Mr. Ingham, who had been appointed as a special master, and the special master was Bill Davis's idea also, to have him compare what was produced by the Davenport Police Department to the file that I had from Mr. McKenrick as to the reports that had been provided to the defense.
Right. Did that comparison turn up any other reports beyond the Sarah B. report that were not in the defense file?
Yes. The special master determined there were 77 reports that had never been turned over to the defense. Of those 77, 56 or something in that area had all been generated before the second jury trial in 1995.
Did those 77 reports include details from an interview with Daryl Sheese?
Yes.
Did those 77 reports include details from an interview with Michael Armstrong?
Yes.
And did those 77 reports include details from an interview with Sean Saunders?
Yes.
Derek was asking Kent about people who were all interviewed by police around the same time as Donna Atkins, that witness who testified that she smelled gasoline and saw a gas can in Stanley's car in the parking lot of the Hillside Inn. Daryl Sheese was Donna's boyfriend, who was leaving the Hillside Inn for an alcohol treatment facility. In the police report that was turned over, Daryl told police he didn't remember seeing a red Peugeot in the parking lot, but he did remember seeing a brown Mustang. Sean Saunders owned a brown Mustang that was parked at the Hillside Inn, but she says she never had a gas can in the car. And Mike Armstrong said he would drive Sean Saunders' Mustang occasionally, but he never had a gas can in the car either, and he never loaned the Mustang to anybody else. After Derek Jones finished questioning Ken Simmons, Scott County Prosecutor Mike Walton cross-examined him and questioned the relevance of the missing 77 police reports that keep getting brought up.
At some point, you were provided all of those reports, 77.
Correct, during the first post-conviction.
And you went through all of those 77 reports.
Yes.
You had discussions with Mr. Bill Davis, the county attorney, about those reports.
I would say so, yes.
It was the subject of hearings and motions.
Yes.
And with all of those 77 reports, it came down to only 4 pages that were at issue, correct?
You would have to tell me which 4 pages you're talking about.
I'd be talking about the report of Mr. Sheese, the report of Ms. Saunders, the report of Mr. Armstrong, and report of Sarah B. Klingsick.
Well, those were the things that were addressed in the first post-conviction, yes. There were other reports.
I'm just referring to the 77 reports that you reviewed. Those were the 4 reports that became an issue.
Then he summed up the contents of the 3 reports related to the Donna Atkins testimony.
So out of those 3 reports regarding Donna Atkins, what we have is Mr. Shee saying he does not recall seeing the vehicle, but that there was a brown Mustang in that area, correct?
Correct.
We have Ms. Saunders saying that she owns a brown Mustang, but had never put a gas can in it ever and did not own one.
Correct.
And that she had seen the red Peugeot in the parking lot before, and Stanley Liggins, correct?
That she believes so, I think is what it says.
And then Mr. Armstrong's statement was that he had borrowed the brown Mustang but had never put a gas can in it.
Yes.
All right. And that's the sum and substance of those reports that were not provided, those 3 reports of the 4, that were not provided to the defense for those 2 trials.
Well, I don't think you stated everything that's in the reports, but those reports are the complete reports, yes.
Well, should I read the reports in their entirety?
Objection, argumentative.
It's overruled.
Is that the gist of what is in those reports?
Yes, you have to put the 3 reports together, though, to see how it makes sense.
Is there anything that's contained within the 3 reports that you think I left out or that you should put in the record to make it more accurate?
Only if I were to make an argument as to what the evidence shows.
I'm just talking not what you think it shows. What is there anything that you think I left out that you think should be made part of this record? Because we can put it in right now.
Do you want me to explain what the evidence shows?
No, okay. That's not my question.
And the answer is no, you left nothing out.
All right. So what we just went through covers what is in these reports.
Correct.
All right.
As Mike Walton pointed out, nothing in these reports actually contradicts what Donna Adkins testified to in regards to seeing a gas can and smelling gas fumes coming from a red Peugeot. But Donna Adkins and her boyfriend, Daryl Sheese, have since died. So the defense argues that since they didn't know about the other reports, they didn't have the chance to properly cross-examine and challenge her testimony. But Mike Armstrong and Sean Saunders are alive and can presumably testify. So Scott County Judge Marlita Grieve denied the defense's motion. In her ruling, she writes the defense will be able to provide the jury with reasons to question Donna Adkins' former testimony through these new witnesses. Now, the fourth report that Kent Simmons cited during that first post-conviction hearing was Sarah Klingsek's.
In that report, Ms. Klingsek states she observed what she thought was garbage burning in the field behind Jefferson School, correct?
That's what the report says, yes.
All of my questions will be directed towards what the report says.
Okay.
And a couple other smaller fires in the general area.
Correct.
She thought nothing unusual of it and drove by, said she saw what she thought was a red Camaro also driving by slowly in front of her. Is that correct?
That's what it says.
She testified she had no idea what the plates or any description of the occupants.
Correct.
She said she had no, the report indicates she had no further information.
That's what it says, yes.
So the fourth of the 77 reports that you felt were at issue was Sarah B. Klingsek basically saying she saw what she thought was a garbage fire and then a red Camaro. But she didn't see anything about the occupants or the plates. Is that what that fourth report says?
Correct.
Now, all of those, or those four reports, were addressed in that first post-conviction.
Objection asked and answered.
It's background.
It's overruled. He can answer.
They were addressed, yes.
And Judge Shane Thaler found that Sarah B. was not credible. Is that correct?
That was his conclusion.
That was a conclusion affirmed by the Iowa Court of Appeals.
Correct.
And that was a conclusion also echoed by the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals when he brought the writ of habeas corpus.
Correct.
In fact, all three of those courts found that there was no Brady violation as a result of those reports.
The Supreme Court case Brady v. Maryland found that under the Due Process Clause, the prosecution has an obligation to turn over all exculpatory evidence, evidence that's favorable to the defendant, and if it's presented, there would be a reasonable probability that this evidence could result in a different outcome. So a Brady violation occurs when the prosecution withholds evidence from the defense that could have resulted in an exoneration for the defendant. And Mike Walton is correct that the first courts denied a Brady violation because they found that those missing reports wouldn't have reasonably ended in a different outcome. But you might have noticed that Mike Walton was specifically asking Kent Simmons about the information he cited during the first post-conviction relief hearing. That's when Judge Shane Thaler denied Stanley's appeal. But listen to this exchange between Mike Walton and Kent Simmons again. Mike was confirming the four reports that Kent cited at the time, and then Kent started to answer.
Well, those were the things that were addressed in the first post-conviction, yes. There were other reports.
I'm just referring to the 77 reports that you reviewed. Those were the four.
Kent started to say that, yes, those were the issues addressed in the first post-conviction, but Mike Walton cuts him off when Kent starts to say, but there are other reports. One of the other reports is an FBI report that Kent obtained in 2011. Like the other 77 discovered, this FBI report had never been turned over to the defense. It has to do with another potential suspect at the time. Eddie Zapien was another one of Joe Glenn's friends, and like Stanley, Eddie was also at the Glenn house the evening Jennifer Lewis was murdered. He left the Glenn's about 20 minutes after Stanley. During an earlier post-conviction hearing, Kent Simmons questioned Davenport Police Lieutenant Don Schaefer about why Eddie Zapien was ruled out as a suspect. Don Schaefer answered that he had recently seen an FBI report that had determined an alibi. Now that Kent Simmons has seen that report, he questions the methods the FBI used to confirm the alibi. Derek Jones questioned Kent about that report.
Does Defense Exhibit MAI, the FBI report, provide the details of how Mr. Zapien was questioned about his whereabouts?
Yes.
And that report was not available to the defense team in 1993, is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. If I'm understand it correctly, Mr. Zapien claimed he had visited someone named Sue and Eli with an unknown last name. He had visited people named Sue, S-U-E, and Eli, E-L-I, last name unknown, who resided somewhere off Kennedy Drive?
Correct.
Without any further specifics of where that house was located?
Correct.
Or what their last names was?
Correct.
Would having this report have been helpful to the defense during the 1993 trial?
Certainly.
In what way could this report have been used to help Mr. Liggins during the 1993 trial?
Well, what could have been established with Mr. Schaefer on the stand was that, in fact, the FBI did not verify an alibi. They took information that Mr. Zapien had given them as to where he had been, but unless there's more reports out there I have not seen, the FBI never attempted to locate Sue and Eli, so that I guess Mr. Zapien's own explanation of where he was at the time without verification would be a great subject for cross-examination of Mr. Schaefer.
Now, was Lieutenant Schaefer called as a witness in the second trial concerning eliminating Eddie Zapien as a suspect?
No, I don't believe so.
Okay. Had the defense team had Defense Exhibit MAI at the time of the 1995 trial, would that have enable them to explore this issue with Lieutenant Schaefer?
Sir,
I'm going to object that this is gross speculation at this point about what somebody might have done if they had something. He didn't even question them about it. I think he's answered the importance of the Zapien report when he was questioned about it. He wasn't even questioned about it.
It's overruled. He can answer that.
Could you restate the question?
Yeah. If the defense team in the 95 trial had Exhibit MAI, would that have enabled them to call Lieutenant Schaefer to discuss the way Eddie Zapien had been eliminated as a suspect?
Yes.
And how would they have used it the same way you just described with respect to the 1993 trial?
Yes, it would be used to determine that Eddie Zapien's whereabouts had never been fully investigated, or that his story as to where he was had ever been corroborated.
Thank you. I have no further questions, Your Honor.
Eddie Zapien drove a red Chevrolet Impala and left shortly after Stanley that night. And as we know, Stanley's car has been a huge symbol in this case, especially after it was dramatically displayed in the courtroom. but a criminalist did testify that they could not find a trace of Jennifer Lewis in the Peugeot or in Stanley's room at the Hillside Inn. Eddie Zapian's car wasn't analyzed in the same way because he was cleared as a suspect early on. But the FBI report now shows that his alibi perhaps wasn't properly vetted. And Joe Glenn's alibi that night was mostly corroborated by his wife, Sherry, and the police noted that the Glenns didn't have a car to drive that night. The defense attorneys in the first two cases didn't have access to these missing reports, so they couldn't use them to create reasonable doubt on the jury. But in 2 months, we'll go to Waterloo, Iowa, for Stanley Ligon's third jury trial for the murder of Jennifer Lewis. We don't know how it will end, but the defense attorneys will certainly have more opportunities to cast doubt. Production support comes from Alfredo Manteca. Big thanks to Colin Thompson and Cast Media for our online presence. And thank you to WVIK CEO Jay Pierce and the WVIK staff. All archived audio was generously provided by WQAD-TV Channel 8.